Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Talking about Book 2, Chapter 1, Parade, the father figure. That was my discussion prompt. Father figure. Ooh, I can see. Swim said the Mama Fishy made a comment 2 minutes ago. Just got in there by 2 minutes. Nicely done. Jan Brunt, though, first off, said a couple of quick notes for context. We're entering Paris with Julian in the same time period that some of the later events of Les Mis take place. Note that the book was written in 1862, looking back on events, whereas The Red and the Black is contemporary. The reference to the Place de la Grève refers to an area in Paris that was historically the marketplace and the place of public execution. Grève means gravel, and refers to the gravel bank that used to exist on the scene, on that spot. It is now the location of the Hotel de Ville, City Hall. Readers of The Hunchback of Notre Dame will remember the Place de la Grève as the site of Quasimodo's punishment in the stocks. Laura Weistich said, being that I'm also in a year of Les Mis, this is useful to know. Thanks. By the way, there is also a subreddit called A Year of Les Miserables and A Year of War and Peace, where you can read those books in a similar book group. A lot of crossover members too. They're sister subreddits, I suppose you'd call them. Swim said the Mama Fishy, who got in by 2 minutes with that comment. I enjoined St. Gerard's lines about the provinces. I am running away from the ghastly life one leads in the provinces. I love the freshness of the woods and the peacefulness of the fields, the politics that's chasing me away. Pretty soon I will be being harassed by 1,000 prying questions and nuisances. For me, the peace of the countryside was a hell, I believe, so help me that if the priest had taken it into his head to accuse me of murdering his servant from both political parties, there would have been 20 witnesses from both political parties swearing they saw me committing the crime. I'm getting out of that inferno of hypocrisy and troublemaking. I propose to look for the peace and solitude of the countryside in the only place in France where those things can be found, a fourth floor apartment overlooking the Champs-Élysées. The discussion about Bonaparte was interesting. It's all your Bonaparte's work. A decent man can't settle down in the provinces and find peace there. The priests and the country aristocracy chased him off. No, don't say such things, awful things about him. Back then, there was something grand about everything we did. Your empire was only grand in the field of when we put our finances on sound footing in 1802. After that, he gave us a new edition of all that kindly, kingly twaddle. Next to the priests, it was the petty provincial aristocrats who gave me the most trouble. It's Bonaparte. May heaven close its doors against him and all his monarchy's rubbish. Who put the Rainals and the Chelan in power, and it's them that gave us the Valenods and the Maslons. It's quite different, that translation, I think, from what we're reading. By the sounds of things. Oh. Excuse me. Let's read chapter 2, straight on with the show tonight, because I'm seeing double, my brain is not working. Chapter 2 is called Entry into the World, an absurd and touching memory, the first salon in which one appeared on one's own at the age of 18, the very glance of a woman was sufficient to frighten me, the more I tried to please, the more awkward I became. I conceived all the most mistaken ideas. Either I let down my guard for no reason, or I thought a man or an enemy simply because he looked at me seriously. But even then, in the depths of terrible shyness, how very fine a fine day was. That is, can't. Julian stood overwhelmed in the middle of the courtyard. Do try to look like a reasonable being, said Abe Perard. You have those grisly notions, and then you behave just like a child. Where's Horace? Nil mirari. No enthusiasm. Remember that the nation of lackeys you see living here will want to make fun of you. They'll view you as an equal, unjustly set over them. Beneath their friendly manners, their good advice, the wish to set you right, they'll want to lead you into some gross blunder. I defy them to, said Julian, biting his lip, and with all his distrust flooding back. The salons on the first floor that these gentlemen passed through before reaching the Marquise's study would seem to you, dear reader, as depressing as they were magnificent. Should someone make you a present of them as they stand, you would refuse to live there. They are the natural home of yawns and tedious disquisitions. They redoubled Julian's enchantment. How, thought he, could anyone be unhappy living in so splendid a setting? Eventually our gentleman came to the ugliest room in this opulent suite, where scarcely any daylight entered. There they found a thin little man with lively eyes and wearing a blonde periwig. The abbe turned to Julian and introduced him. It was the Marquis. Julian hardly recognized him, for his manner was so civil. This was no longer the grandee with so lofty an air he had seen at the Abbey of Brayley Haut. Julian thought that his periwig had much too much hair in it, and spurred on by that impression he was not shy at all. This descendant of the friend of Henry III seemed to him at first to cut a poor figure. Excuse me. He was extremely thin and fidgeted too much, but he soon discovered that the Marquis manifested a courtesy even more agreeable than that of the Bishop of Bezicon himself. The audience lasted no more than 3 minutes. As they were leaving, the abbe said to Julian, You stared at the Marquis as though he were a painting. I'm no great hand at what these people here call politeness. Soon you'll know more than I do, but the intensity of your glare did not seem very polite to me. They had got up into the fiacre again. Then the coachman pulled up at the edge of the boulevard. The abbe conducted Julian into a large suite of rooms. Julian noticed that there was no furniture. He was inspecting a magnificent gilded clock decorated with a subject he found highly indecent when he was approached by an extremely elegant gentleman with a smiling air. Julian made a half bow. The gentleman smiled and laid his hand on his shoulder. Julian started and jumped backwards. He reddened in anger. The abbe, Pirard, despite his gravity, laughed till he wept. The gentleman was a tailor. "I give you your freedom for 48 hours, and the abbe said, as they left, "not until then can you be presented to Madame de la Mole. Someone else might watch over you in these first days of your stay in this new Babylon as if you were a young girl, but damn yourself straight away if you are to be damned, and I'll be freed from my weakness in thinking of you. The day after tomorrow the tailor will bring you 2 suits. Give 5 francs to the boy as who fits them, but otherwise don't let these Parisians hear the sound of your voice. If you say a single word, they'll discover how to make fun of you. It's their particular gift. The day after tomorrow, come to me at midday. Go ahead, damn yourself, I forgot. Go and order some boots, some shirts and hat at the address listed here." Julian looked at the writing on the list. "It's the Marquis's own handwriting," said the abbe. "He's an energetic man who foresees everything. He'd rather than that than issue orders. He's employing you close to him so that you can spare him that kind of chore. Have you the intelligence to carry out efficiently all that is mercurial man will suggest by a word or two? The future will tell. Take care." Julian went without a word to the craftsmen whose addresses were listed. He observed that they received him with respect, and that the bootmaker, entering his name in the ledger, wrote M. Julian de Sorrel. At the cemetery of Pere Lachaise, the gentleman who appeared most obliging and even more frank in his conversation offered to show Julian the tomb of Marshal Ney, whom prudent policy has denied the honour of an epitaph. But on parting from this liberal, who with tears in his eyes had almost clasped him to his bosom, Julian found his watch missing. It was on the following day at noon that, richer for his experience, he presented himself to Abbe Pirard, who inspected him closely. "Perhaps you'll become a fop," said the abbe severely. Julian had the look of a very young man in deep mourning. In truth, he looked very fine, but the good priest was himself too provincial to see that Julian still retained that movement of the shoulders that only provincials think both elegant and important-looking. When the Marquis saw Julian, he judged of his graces so differently from the abbe that he asked him, "Would you have any objection to Monsieur Sorel taking dancing lessons?" The abbe stood, transfixed. "No," he replied at last. "Julian isn't a priest." Running 2 steps at a time up a little hidden stair, the Marquis himself installed our hero in a pretty attic mansard, giving on to the mansion's enormous gardens. He asked him how many shirts he had ordered from the shirtmaker. 2, replied Julian, awed to find so great a man descend to these details. "Very good," said the Marquis with a serious air and a short and authoritative voice that impressed Julian. "Very good. Order another 22. Here's the first quarterly installment on your salary. Coming down from the attic, the Marquis called out to an old man. Arsene, he said, you will look after Monsieur Sorel. A few minutes later, Julian found himself alone in the magnificent library. It was a delightful moment. So as not to be discovered in his emotional state, he went to hide himself in a small dark corner. From there, he rapturously contemplated the shining backs of the books. I'll be able to read them all, he said to himself, and how could I not like it here? Monsieur de Renal would have thought himself eternally dishonoured by doing a hundredth part of what the Marquis de La Mole has done, just done for me. But let's look at the copying that he has to be done. This work completed, Julian. Julian ventured to approach the books. He could scarce control his joy on finding an edition of Voltaire. He ran to open the library doors so as not to be caught unawares. Then he gave himself the pleasure of opening each one of the 80 volumes. They were magnificently bound, the best work of the best bookbinder in London. Nothing more was needed for Julian's cup to run over. An hour later, the Marquis came in, looked at the copies, and saw with amazement that Julian wrote that with two T's at the end. That. So everything the Abbe has told me about his learning is just a fantasy. Most put out, the Marquis gently said to him, you're not sure of your spelling. That's perfectly true, said Julian, without beginning to realize the damage he was doing to himself. He was reassured by the Marquis's kind tones, which put him in mind of Monsieur de Renal's harsh ones. It is just a waste of time, this experiment with a little Abbe from French Comte, thought the Marquis, but I had such need of a reliable man. That is written with only one T at the end, he said. When your copies are finished, look up the words you're not certain of in the dictionary. At 6 o'clock, the Marquis sent for him and glanced at Julian's boots with evident distaste. It's my mistake. I haven't told you that every day at 5:30 you must get dressed. Julian stared at him without understanding. I mean, put on stockings. Arsene will remind you today. I'll make your excuses. Having said this, Monsieur de La Mole conducted Julian into a salon resplendent with gold leaf. Monsieur de Renal, on comparable occasions, had always doubled his pace to have distinction of going through the door first, so this petty vanity in his old patron caused Julian to stumble on the Marquis's heels and give the latter considerable pain from his gout. Ah, he's even more of a booby than I'd bargained for, he said to himself. He presented him to a tall woman of imposing appearance. It was the Marquise. Julian had the impression of an insolent air, rather like that of Madame de Moiron, wife of the sub-prefect of Verrières, when she went to the St. Charles Day dinner on November 4th. Somewhat confused by the great splendour of the salon, Julian did not hear what Monsieur de La Mole was saying. The Marquis scarcely deigned to look at him. There were several men in the room, among whom Julian recognised with indescribable pleasure the young Bishop of Agde, who had condescended to speak to him some time ago at the ceremony of Brayley Haut. Doubtless this young prelate was alarmed by the tender gaze that Julian's shyness fixed upon him. He did not trouble to acknowledge this provincial. The men gathered in the salon seemed to Julian somewhat melancholy and constrained. People speak softly in Paris and do not exaggerate small matters. At about 6:30, a handsome young man with a moustache, very pale and very slight, came in. He had an extremely small head. "You always keep people waiting," said the Marquis, whose hand he was kissing. Julian understood that this was Comte de Mole. From the first, he found him charming. "Is it possible," he asked himself, "that this can be the man whose aggressive jocularity will drive me from this house?" From looking at Comte Norbert over, Julian registered that he was wearing boots and spurs, and I should be in pumps, obviously, as an inferior. They went to table. Julian heard the Marquise saying something in a severe tone, raising her voice slightly. Almost at the same moment he noticed an extremely fair-haired and very shapely young woman about to sit down opposite him. She did not attract him at all. Nevertheless, on looking attentively at her, he thought he had never seen such beautiful eyes, but they promised great coldness of heart. As time passed, Julian detected in them an expression of bored inquisitiveness, together with the consciousness of the obligation to be impressive. Madame de Renal, too, has very lovely eyes, he thought. Everyone compliments her on them, and they have nothing in common with these. Julian did not know enough to realize that it was the fire of wit that shone from time to time in the eyes of Madame Mathilde, as he heard her called. When Madame de Renal's eyes sparkled, it was with the fire of passion, or from generous indignation at hearing of some wicked action. Towards the end of the meal, Julien hit on a word to express the type of beauty that Mademoiselle de la Mole's eyes possessed. "They are scintillating," he said to himself. Otherwise, she was cruelly like her mother, whom he liked less and less, and he stopped looking at her. By contrast, Comte Norbert seemed to him admirable in every way. Julien was so taken with him that he had no notion of being envious and hating him for being richer and better born than he. Julien noticed that the Marquis seemed bored. Around the time the second course was served, he said to his son, "Norbert, I must ask you for your good will towards Monsieur Julien Sorel, whom I am just about to take on my staff, and of whom I intend to make something, if that's possible." "He's my secretary," he remarked to his neighbour, "and he writes that with two T's." Everyone glanced at Julien, who bowed his head perhaps a little too emphatically towards Norbert, but in general people were satisfied by his appearance. The Marquise must have talked of the kind of education Julien received, for one of the guests started on the subject of Horace. "It was precisely in talking about Horace that I succeeded with the Bishop of Besançon," said Julien to himself. "Apparently this is the only author they know." From that moment on, he was in control of himself. The achievement was easy because he had just decided that Mademoiselle de la Mole could never be a woman to his eyes. Ever since the seminary, he had defied men to do their worst, and that made it difficult for them to frighten him. He would have enjoyed perfect self-possession if the dining room had been less magnificently furnished. In fact, there was a pair of mirrors, each 8 feet high, and in which he could sometimes glimpse his adversary talking about Horace. That still made him nervous. For a provincial, his sentences were not too long. He had fine eyes, whose brilliance was enhanced by the tremulous fire of his shyness, or by the pleasure it generated in him when making a good reply. He was found to be agreeable. The kind of examination injected some interest into the solemn dinner. The Marquis signaled to Julien's opponent to press him hard. "Is it possible that he knows something?" he wondered. In the process of answering, Julien hit upon new insights, and lost enough of his nerves to display, not perhaps wit, an impossibility for someone ignorant of the current Paris way of speaking, but ideas that, though delivered without grace and not quite to the point, did demonstrate that he knew Latin perfectly. Julien's opponent was a member of the Academy of Inscriptions, who by chance knew Latin. Finding Julien a very good scholar, he dismissed his scruples about making him blush and tried to push him really hard. In the heat of combat, Julien at last forgot the magnificent furnishings of the dining room and produced ideas about the Roman poets that his interlocutor had never read anywhere. As an honest man, he gave the secretary credit for them. By good luck, they embarked on a discussion as to whether Horace had been rich or poor. A pleasant man, pleasure-loving, carefree, writing verse to amuse himself like Chapelle, the friend of Molière and La Fontaine, or a poor devil of a poet laureate, following the court and composing odes to the king's birthday like Southey, Lord Byron's accuser. There was talk of the state of society under Augustus and under George IV, two periods when the aristocracy had been all-powerful, although in Rome they had seen their power wrenched from them by Maecenas, who was a mere knight. That's my phone going beep. Whereas in England they had reduced George IV almost to the condition of the Doge of Venice. This discussion seemed to rouse the Marquis from the state of torpor or boredom into which he had been plunged at the beginning of the meal. Julien knew nothing of the modern names, such as Southey, Lord Byron, George IV. He was hearing them pronounced for the first time, but no one could fail to observe that, whenever it was a question of what had happened in Rome, and about which information could be deduced from the works of Horace, Martial, Tacitus, etc., he displayed unchallengeable superiority. Julien blithely expounded several ideas, which he had taken from the Bishop of Besançon, in their famous discussion. These were not the least to be admired. When they were tired of talking about poets, the Marquise, who had made it a rule to like everything that amused her husband, deigned to look at Julien. "This young Abe's awkward manners perhaps concealed a learned man," said the academician seated next to her. And Julien partly overheard these words. Ready-made phrases suited the temperament of the mistress of the house. She adopted this one about Julien and thought herself well advised to have invited the academician to dinner. "He will entertain Monsieur de la Mole," she thought. All right, there we go. That's the chapter. That's the chapter done. Oh, that goes there. Have your say about that one on the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.